It is Friday, June 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump welcomes South Korea's president to the White House and calls for a more equitable trade deal. Facebook celebrates its 2 billionth user milestone, and country music fans get ready for the summer. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump, who's hosting South Korean President Moon Jae-in, says he hopes to renegotiate an equitable trade deal with Seoul. The two leaders spoke in the Rose Garden at the White House. Trump said the current U.S.-South Korean trade agreement is not fair.
Our trade deficit with South Korea has increased by more than $11 billion. Not exactly a great deal.
Trump also spoke of the North Korean military threat.
The North Korean dictatorship has no regard for the safety and security of its people or its neighbors and has no respect for human life.
I spoke with VOA reporter Bill Gallo and asked him to explain Trump's negative view towards the current trade deal with South Korea.
Well, we don't know a lot about the specifics, but what he announced yesterday was that they're renegotiating a trade deal. He actually announced that over Twitter. And then today he's made a couple different comments. He called it not a very great trade deal. He once again complained about the increase in the trade deficit since the trade deal went into place. And he says he's confident that they can get a positive outcome on that. But, you know, as far as details, we don't really know yet.
So there's been no real reaction, I guess, yet from South Korean officials to this.
No, you know, President Moon didn't really address this issue in his comments today. He was more focused on North Korea and sort of avoided some of Trump's comments on trade.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Trump also spoke out against, condemned North Korea for its lack of human rights. And he also said the U.S., the U.S. wants to see peace in the region, in that area of Asia. But he also said the U.S. will always defend itself, always. Was that a line aimed at the North Korean leadership?
Yeah, it seems like it. I mean, there was some tough words said about North Korea. The most notable, I think, probably was that Trump really reinforcing the fact that the era of strategic patience is over. That's how he and some Obama officials have characterized their approach to North Korea in the past. But Trump has made this comment in several different instances over the last couple months. He clearly prefers an approach of putting more pressure on North Korea. Moon, on the other hand, prefers more engagement. And, you know, that is an area of disagreement. However, in their comments today, they sort of presented a unified front on North Korea.
You know, talking about the long-term relationship between the U.S. and North Korea, Mr. Trump said that Vice President Pence and President Moon early this morning toured the Korean War Monument and, you know, talked about that there's a long partnership between the two countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they do have a long partnership. And I think it's important to note that while they have differences, the differences between South Korea and the U.S. governments right now seems to primarily be one of tactics rather than strategy. I think both sides clearly want the peninsula to be denuclearized. They both would enter into some sort of talks. I think really the question here is how much pressure to put on North Korea before those talks resume. Moon wants to restart those talks very quickly, and President Trump, it seems, wants to apply many more sanctions before entering those discussions.
That's VOA's Bill Gallo. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, a story that we talked about yesterday involving television host Mika Brzezinski and President Trump's tweets at her saying that she had a facelift and calling her crazy. Well, now Mika Brzezinski and her co-host and fiancé, Joe Scarborough, are alleging that President Trump has tried to collude with the National Enquirer, which is a tabloid magazine, to try to blackmail them. You said it, I think, best right before we went on air. It's kind of like a soap opera. It's hard to keep up with all the updates.
Well, but also, I think President Trump is a good friend of the publisher, owner of the Enquirer.
He is. So it's, you know, amidst all of the kind of funny and bizarre reaction to all this. Some people are saying it would be very troubling if a U.S. president was colluding with the media or a publisher to try to say terrible things about other members of the media. So it's just, it's very convoluted, but it's something that social media is talking about quite a lot today. But the big occasion to celebrate today is hashtag Social Media Day. It's the 8th annual Global Social Media Day, which was first launched by the website Mashable back 8 years ago. So people are celebrating this and talking about the good, the bad, and the funny on social media. So we have the good, people looking at how far social media has taken us even in the past 8 years, connecting people around the world. Of course, we talked about now Facebook has more than 2 billion users around the world, and CEO Mark Zuckerberg has talked about a mission to connect global communities through Facebook. And it's done other things that we've talked about on the show before, improving public safety, raising awareness of different issues around the world. We've talked about Facebook Safety Check, where people can check in times of disaster or emergency. Mm-hmm. So it really has been an invaluable tool in raising awareness and helping people around the world.
And also, I know as a journalist, getting ideas for stories. Sometimes you'll see an article and you can, you know, communicate with that person is really amazing.
Absolutely. The level of information that this has opened up to people around the world and allowed them to see different stories and different perspectives. Really has been huge for information sharing. However, the flip side of that is the bad side, the awful side. People talking about hate speech, extremism. Of course, we've talked about ISIS using social media to try to recruit. The hyper-politicized nature of social media. Everyone seems to be sniping back and forth about politics. And then as we were just talking about President Trump's tweets, that back and forth, that story, having a lot of people talking. So there are the negative moments that come up on social media. But I think this one is my favorite, the funny. We have the memes, the viral moments, the stories that have made us laugh that we may never have heard of if not for social media. And a lot of people citing that famous Andy Warhol line that in the future everybody will have 15 minutes of fame. And they said, well, if only Andy knew that social media would bring everybody that 15 minutes. It seems that that's how everybody's going viral. But lots of people celebrating this, posting their favorite memes and posts and videos online. And I think my favorite is this tweet somebody put up and said, today is Social Media Day, also known as Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Because, of course, everybody's on social media all the time. It really isn't just limited to one day a year. It really is a 365-day-a-year kind of thing.
And I keep wondering what Andy Warhol would have thought of Twitter. You know, I can just see those Campbell soup cans all over the place.
I think he would have found it pretty bizarre, and I think that's what a lot of people are saying today. But, again, a useful source of information as well.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. President Trump's revised travel order takes effect. Jailed Nobel Prize laureate Liu Xiaobo's case casts a shadow over Hong Kong's 20th anniversary following the end of British rule. Germany votes to legalize same-sex marriage. And a U.S. proposal to sell Taiwan arms risks a Chinese backlash at an awkward time. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A study published by the journal Nature about 8 months ago found that 115 years is the upper limit of human age. But others have lived much longer than that. The oldest person on record lived to be 122 years and 164 days. A pair of Canadian researchers who recently published their own study in Nature seem to come to different conclusions than those in the earlier study. The scientists from Montreal's McGill University say they couldn't find any evidence of the 115-year limit on human life, or if any limit has been reached or could be identified. One of the researchers, Siegfried Hakemi, says that no one knows what the human age limit might be, and that it's impossible to predict what future lifespans in humans might look like. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the EU pledges support as Italy threatens to close ports. The founder of Facebook, the world's largest social media network, announced this week it had reached a new milestone, 2 billion people who regularly use it. That's defined as a registered Facebook user who logged in and visited through its website or a mobile device or used its Messenger app in the past 30 days. Mark Zuckerberg, who founded the company in his college dormitory in 2004, said Facebook is making progress connecting the world, and now let's bring the world closer together. The network's nearest rivals are WeChat, mostly used in China, at 889 million, Twitter's 328 million, and Snapchat's estimated 255 million users. To increase its user base in the developing world, the company is using apps that require less data, low bandwidth connections, and even solar-powered drones to extend internet connectivity. It added about 750 million users outside the U.S. and Canada since 2012, when it reached 1 billion members. Brian Blau is research director of U.S.-based Gartner, a technology research company. He was asked by International Edition's Victor Beatty what Zuckerberg means by bringing the world closer together.
Using digital technology like Facebook.com or the app or really any app that you have tends to, you know, make personal interactions not so personal, maybe compared to when you're face-to-face. I think Zuckerberg is thinking about how can he improve the technology so that it brings people together that maybe aren't necessarily having a face-to-face conversation. How can they improve the technology to make people relate better to each other, to give them more information about each other and the world that they're in? And that likely will improve sort of the situation and create less of a difference between being face-to-face and being real and being online.
There are a lot of concerns about, of course, hate speech and extremist content, trolls, misinformation. How are they dealing with that these days?
You know, managing the community, I think, is an ongoing effort at Facebook. You know, since the election in the U.S. last year, and to be honest, also, you know, through a lot of the terrorist activities that have happened and all of those sort of nefarious people using social networks to their advantage, I think Facebook has taken a hard look at their rules about content, who can post, how people can post, and what they can say. They're taking a balanced approach, meaning that, you know, they're trying to let people be who they are and say what they want and do what they want. But, you know, based on some, you know, type of community standard, they're having to make a judgment call. They also have other technology sort of weapons, if you will, using artificial intelligence to help find trouble before it really starts and gets big, especially combating anybody that's using pictures or video. So oftentimes it's not just about, you know, banning something, but how fast can they react?
Of course, Mark Zuckerberg's origins of Facebook began in a college dorm room back in 2004. The growth has been amazing over these 13 years. He's lured a lot of advertisers. What is his key to maintaining his dominance in the social media area?
There have been others that have attempted the same thing that Facebook has, and certainly there's been competitors, and Facebook wasn't the first. You know, like a lot of Silicon Valley businesses, oftentimes, it's about being at the right place at the right time with the right thing. You know, Zuckerberg had great timing. There were other social networks that were before him, and the reason that he created what he did was sort of in response to a lack of something that he couldn't get, you know, using someone else's software. And oftentimes, that's what we see as the root of innovation and success in Silicon Valley.
That's Brian Blau. He's a research director of the technology company Gartner. Facebook chief product officer Chris Cox told the website TechCrunch the company is now at the point where it's trying to understand how the product is being used. He said Zuckerberg has been traversing the U.S. on a listening tour. Cox said Facebook wants to find ways to maximize the good things that take place on its network while curtailing ways it's being misused or turned into something sad. The European Union has pledged to support Italy as it continues to admit thousands of migrants who are crossing every day from North Africa across the Mediterranean. Italy has threatened to shut its ports to foreign registered boats carrying migrants. So far this year, nearly 80,000 people have made the journey and more than 2,000 have died. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Oh! Most of the tens of thousands of people plucked from the Mediterranean this week have been taken to ports on the Italian coast. They are severely dehydrated, usually malnourished, and suffering from infections and skin diseases. Marcella Cray of Doctors Without Borders spoke to VOA via Skype from the group's rescue ship, Aquarius, as it disembarked over 1,000 migrants at the Italian port of Corigliano Calabro.
We also see the results of people actually being physically assaulted, sexually assaulted, tortured.
Italy's representative to the European Union has warned the situation is unsustainable and threatened to stop vessels of other countries from bringing migrants to its ports. Cray sympathizes with Italy's position.
We have not in any way formally informed of this by the Italian government. My first impression of this is that the main thing is here is that it's actually a cry for help coming from the Italian government. And it would be actually good for other EU member states to take a bit more responsibility.
EU Migration Commissioner Dimitris Avramopoulos offered Italy his support.
Italy is under huge pressure, and we're not going to leave this country alone.
Italy is obliged to take in the migrants, says refugee law expert Professor Jeff Gilbert of the University of Essex, also via Skype.
The law of the sea, international refugee law and international human rights law are all coming into play together. Italy has the right to protect its own borders. While I have a lot of sympathy for the Italian situation, I do not believe Italy can send back boats, even boats that are seaworthy, on into the Mediterranean.
Gilbert says Rome is likely trying to force the implementation of the 2015 EU agreement to share refugees across the bloc, which has so far made little progress. This week, more than 400 migrants in Italy clashed with police at the French border, demanding to be allowed through. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country in
Think
the world.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Summer's here, and with the new season comes new music. Nikki Strong of VOA One The Hits shares some of the new country music set to hit the stores. So what's coming down the pike, Nikki?
Well, a couple that have already hit this month that I'd like to include, because some people may not be aware of these, and these are good projects. Gretchen Wilson's Ready to Get Rowdy. Now, Gretchen's biggest signature hit is the Grammy-winning Redneck Woman. And that was from, I love that song, from her multi-platinum 2004 project, Here for the Party. But, you know, since then, she's produced great and award-winning music. But it's been about 4 years since she's done something new. And her current project, I love it. It's gritty, it's funky, it's rocky, like a redneck woman. And it's called Ready to Get Rowdy.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Another CD that's just been released to rave reviews that I recommend is Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit, the Nashville Sound. So that's another sweet project. Some CDs that are not out yet that fans are looking forward to include Shania Twain's Now, which technically will be out in the fall, but that's September 29th. Sarah Evans' Words, that's off of her brand new label that she created called Born to Fly Records. That's out July 21st, so I'm really curious about that one. Brett Eldredge's self-titled project drops August the 4th. Loretta Lynn, August the 18th. It's called Wouldn't It Be Great? And that project will include new material, as well as her renditions on previously released material. Her daughter, Patsy Lynn Russell, and Johnny Cash's son, John Cater Cash, produced it.
Wow. Yeah. Well, now, isn't Loretta Lynn recovering from a recent stroke?
She is. She is. She had one in early May. She recently canceled some shows in July to take the time she needs to heal. She's expected to make a full recovery. And according to Closer Weekly, this just came out, her brother, Herman Webb, released an update. And he said that even though she was kind of paralyzed, I think it's on her left side, that she's doing really well now. She can get around by herself. She uses a walker, but her recovery is on its way. And he says that making music has been very therapeutic for her. So I do not think that the CD will be pushed back at all.
Oh, well, that's great news.
Yeah.
You can hear music from all the aforementioned artists on VOA One's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I should have. And maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should have. If I made you feel second best, boy, I'm sorry I was blind. You were always on my mind. You were always on my mind.
The music of Loretta Lynn brings us an end to the show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
United Nations peacekeepers play a critical role in providing stability in regions recovering from conflict. They can prevent outbreaks of violence and stabilize weak or failed governments, which can serve as havens for terrorists or transnational criminal organizations that foster conditions for mass atrocities. Peacekeeping missions are a critical tool for promoting peace and reconciliation in some of the world's most troubled countries, wrote Major General Michael Rothstein, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Plans, Programs, and Operations in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs. Today, more than 113,000 UN personnel from 124 countries serve in peacekeeping roles in 16 missions around the world, in Africa, the Middle East, the Caribbean, and Europe. The diverse, robust, and demanding mandates of each of these missions see peacekeepers working to contain violent groups, protect civilians, bolster stability, and promote health and well-being. One of the important ways the United States government supports UN peacekeeping is through the Global Peace Operations Initiative, a security assistance program coordinated by State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs. The initiative strengthens international peacekeeping capacity by helping to train and equip peacekeepers to carry out the work that is required of them. To maximize effectiveness, program managers need to understand peacekeeping requirements and shortfalls. That is why representatives from key U.S. government organizations and the United Nations met for 5 days in mid-June at the 11th Global Peace Operations Initiative Worldwide Consultations, sponsored by the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs and the Defense Department's Office of the Secretary of Defense. Participants discussed the evolving nature of peacekeeping, ways to strengthen performance and operational readiness of peacekeeping units, and efforts to address sexual exploitation and abuse by peacekeepers. United Nations peacekeepers play an indispensable role in advancing the cause of peace and security in a world ever more burdened by violence and instability, wrote Deputy Assistant Secretary Rothstein. This is a difficult task, and the United States is committed to working with like-minded countries to continue to push for both greater effectiveness and fiscal efficiency in this important mission. As a leading source of financial, technical, and material support for building peacekeeping capacity, the United States demonstrates its ongoing commitment to effective UN peace operations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.